Coming up on Golf Today, we recognize a first-time winner on the PGA Tour, Sahith Theegala, after a big week in Napa at the Fortinet Championship with family and friends cheering every step of the way. And 1 week out from the Ryder Cup, we catch up with a young star from Team Europe, Nikolai Højgaard. Are the butterflies in the stomach already, or is he calm and composed? And we dig into the Solheim Cup, which begins Friday in Spain. Is this Europe's best team ever? Can Lexi find some form? We want answers on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. Our cup runneth over. Solheim Cup this week, Ryder Cup next week. And I imagine some wine glasses were spilled last night in the Napa Valley.
And some people are going to need some wine over the next couple of weeks to settle some nerves. We see week in, week out what this game does to people as individuals when it comes to pressure. The next couple of weeks, we're going to see the best players in the world have the weight of someone else's expectations and the potential disappointment that comes with that alongside of them. It's what makes Solheim Cup and Ryder Cup weeks, to me, some of the most psychologically fascinating golf we get to watch every couple of years.
Playing for your partner, playing for your country, playing for your continent never gets old. I love this time of year. In his 74th PGA Tour start, big hug with his dad, Merle. Mom Karuna was there as well. Let's hear from a very grateful first-time PGA Tour winner.
My dad's the reason I'm here today. I mean, he introduced me to all sports, most specifically basketball and golf. Just love watching it on TV with him. And you know, all he knew when he came from India is academics and to study. And him and my mom did such a good job of just kind of learning how to almost hybrid parent between this Indian culture and American culture and let me play sports, let me spend a lot of time on sports, put me in basketball club. And you know, my mom drove me to so many practices when my dad was still at work, and just the combined efforts of them to kind of understand that this was my dream and my passion, and for it to become their dream and their passion, especially my dad. My dad just loves sports, and he's a competitor too, even though he's never, you know, really, really played sports. But I think at first it was hard for maybe some of my family and even friends to understand why I was trying to chase playing professional golf. It seems like kind of a pipe dream, but my dad had my back the whole time. He just believed in me from the start and knew that this could be a thing. So, you know, it's tough not to get emotional just thinking about everything he's done, and he's always had my back, and even through my wrist surgery in 2018, 19, thinking, you know, I might never play again. Him just having my back and you know, keep on pushing me. And he also did such a good job of, you know, he was really hard on me, but also, you know, one of my best friends, and always told me to have fun. And the main thing was to just enjoy it, because if you don't enjoy it, then there's no purpose in doing it. Life's too short. So, he was just such a right combination. Now he's the happiest person I know. Zach's the most optimistic person I know. My dad's right there with him. He means the world to me. And my mother keeps him in check, for sure. My mom keeps him in check. Sometimes he loses touch of reality a little bit, but they make a good duo.
Well, the reality is Sahith Theegala is a first-time winner on the PGA Tour, 25 years of age, extremely wise. And I spoke to him in the spring. He said he felt like a different player this year than he was last year. It felt like this day, Eamon, was coming.
It really did, starting last year. I mean, he came painfully close at both the Waste Management and the Travelers back in 2022. And how cool is it to actually hear somebody, and he did this with Kira K. Dixon on the 18th green last night, the first reaction is to thank those who put him in that position to succeed, rather than talking about himself. And that's the American dream writ large right there, of people who come here for academics, build a family, build a life, and this is what it turns into out there. And it was really interesting to watch him hold it together. The wobbles we saw weren't with nerves. They were the wobbles that come with Sahith's game, because there's a terrific theatricality to how he plays golf out there. It's this kind of swashbuckling style. Johnson Wagner last night likened it to Seve. There's a little splash of Arnold Palmer. There's a little splash of Phil Mickelson in there as well. This idea of you don't quite know what he's going to do next. And he's terrific around the greens. He's terrific on the greens. He was top three in both of those categories this week in Napa. But he's 158th in driving accuracy. Mm. And that is usually a pretty good recipe for a lot of drama off the tee and a lot of redemption when you get to the greens.
It's a great comp that you make with Seve, Phil, in those defeats that you cite at the Travelers, for example, in the fairway bunker, he got stuck. In Phoenix, it was a water ball on 17.
Playing aggressively in both cases.
Absolutely. I think that's how he's going to play. And I think to bring up the family is important as well. I got to meet Murli and Karuna, his father and mother, at the Masters this year. Pavan Munjal, the CEO of the Hero Motor Corp, was hosting the family and, among others, a bunch of journalists. And Murli and Karuna were just so proud of their son and what he'd already accomplished before he'd ever won a golf tournament, and they are living the American dream, and they travel. It's a big party, and it's a big group. They live and die with every swing. We saw it in Phoenix. I thought that, the Netflix series did a wonderful job of kind of chronicling this immigrant story, this immigrant journey. He just moved out of Southern California recently, now lives in Houston, Texas, so he's kind of sprouting wings as well. He's a fun person to watch play because of the description of his game, as you described, but also just the family story is very, very intriguing as well.
And that's a good philosophical ecosystem to grow up in, what he just said there, this idea that go out there and have fun. If you're not having fun, don't do it.
Yeah.
Because life's too short. And we see a lot of child prodigies in this game whose parents drive them to succeed in golf. And the whole idea of having fun or don't do it doesn't seem as important to some people out there. And there's a joylessness that can come with the early stages of a professional career, particularly when you start to hit some speed bumps out there, as Sahith has. Mm. To me, it's a wonderful philosophical grounding that he's been given. The family are having a good time. Great. The trajectory is upward for this guy right now.
Yeah, hopefully many more wins for Sahith Theegala. Win number one coming in Napa. If Sahith was the headliner, Justin Thomas, definitely one of the big storylines. A fifth place finish. His best finish, Eamon, since he finished fourth earlier in the season at the WM Phoenix Open. And I love what Stuart Sink, assistant captain to Zach Johnson, said if JT played well, Max Homa too, people would make a huge deal out of it. If he played poorly, they'd make a huge deal out of it. What do you take from this fifth place finish?
It's good confidence for him going in. In a way, it's irrelevant to that broader debate over the Ryder Cup team. It was settled as soon as Zach Johnson made the call and said you are on the team, that you can't litigate whether or not he ought to be on it.
He's there,
anymore.
One of 12
exactly.
Now.
And anything he does, certainly between now and then, is purely for his own fuel to get there. And he strikes me as the kind of guy who's played well in the past. When he's got a little bit of a chip on his shoulder, when he's feeling disrespected in some way. And he's probably, we saw the same out of Shane Lowry had similar comments last week at Wentworth, that when it was criticised that he was chosen for the team, it kind of egged him on a little bit. And Lowry played really well for 71 holes last week as well, and I think it drives guys like this. But it's going to be encouraging for his teammates as well when you see a guy who on the year is tied for 129th in putting, and he was 18th in the field with that stick this week in Napa, and the rest of his games coming around as well. He was certainly showed an improvement over his year, strokes gained off the tee and a strokes gained approach as well. He's a guy who's motivated and he's working at it, and it shows the value of ownership. He said he's taken ownership more and more of his own game, both on the putting front and on the full swing from his dad.
That's the biggest thing for me, was his revelation to Kira K. Dixon that he wanted to do things a little bit more on his own. His dad is still his coach. He will send videos, as he's done since he was a kid, playing AJGA events, and then on to Alabama, on to the Corn Ferry Tour, and on the PGA Tour, sending videos to his dad. But he felt like he had a lot of voices in his ear, and he wanted to figure out how to get through this this valley on his own. And I love that about him. And you were very consistent early on when I had my doubts about whether he should be on that team. You talked about his spirit and his fight. And whether the media makes a big deal out of that fifth place finish, I think he has to feel some great confidence knowing that the game is on an upward trajectory. He finished tied for 12th at the Wyndham, was right there to the very end, just missed out on making the FedEx Cup playoffs. Then in his very next start, he finishes fifth. He was in contention for much of the week. Has to feel very, very good for a player who has not a lot to smile about this season.
You know what else is going to give him confidence is a comment that Rory McIlroy made last week in London, when he said he was somewhat mystified by all of this criticism about JT being on the team, that there are plenty of other guys on the US Ryder Cup team that Rory McIlroy would rather face in a Ryder Cup than Justin Thomas.
Yeah, those guys in both locker rooms know the value of Justin Thomas. Well, from one PGA champ to another, did you hear what Jimmy Walker said over the weekend? This is at the conclusion of the first FedEx Cup fall event, talking about the changes to the system, saying they changed the rules. It's been 125 forever, meaning the exempt status. Then it's like, no, it's 50 or it's 70. It's definitely not 125. It's total BS. That's what I think. I've been working for 11 months to finish 124, and it's like, nope, keep playing. So I'm going to give it all I've got. That's all I can do. I can't tell you how many people texted me saying congrats on making the 125. I'm like, no, man, it's different. I had to explain. They've done such a bad job communicating what is happening, partly because I don't think they knew what was happening, honestly. And J-Dub wasn't done. It's been one way forever. Live in the Saudis happen, and a lot of things change, and everybody freaks out. We sign an agreement that stops litigation. I don't know what's going on. They're talking about a big payout for the players that have stayed. All that is blowing my mind, the tour is doing everything they can to take care of themselves and not for the players. I'm just out here grinding, giving it all I've got. I've given them 20-some-odd years out here, you know?
Yeah, those comments to my Golfway colleague Adam Shupak out in Napa this weekend. And this really does drill to the heart of what's going on with the changes on the PGA Tour right now. Jimmy Walker's not wrong. A lot of these changes are born out of Liv and the desire, not just, it's not a reaction to Liv straightforward, it's a desire to curry favor with the top players. And when Jimmy Walker says, you know, that the somehow the executives of the tour are not looking after the players, they are. They're just not looking after you, Jimmy. They're looking after different players. And the question becomes, what degree of security is Jimmy Walker entitled to for playing mediocre golf? He finished 124th. That's fine. That would have gotten you in under the old system.
It would, but you know what Kobe Bryant said? Job not finished. Job finished. These final seven events. That's what this new system is about.
He's missed 22 cuts in the last two seasons without a single top 10. So, yes, under the old system, Jimmy Walker was playing good enough golf to qualify and keep his card. Under this system, he's not playing good enough golf to do that. He has the opportunity to do so.
Yes.
The kind of guys who the top 20, the top 50 guys who've guaranteed their status, they're going to look at Jimmy's comments and say, yeah, there's a grain of truth to those comments, but you're the poster child for why we think not so many people ought to be given the guaranteed card every year.
Yes.
That there ought to be a little bit more work that goes behind it. And it's not as though he's, you know, just pulling something out of his hat here, that there's no logic to his argument.
Yeah.
There is a logic, but that's the simple reality of it. It's not targeted towards him or to other players. It is simply a means of currying favor with the top guys.
But I also think he's speaking to a larger truth just about the uncertainty about what this future framework will even look like with Liv and the DP World Tour.
Yeah, it's what it's going to look like is probably always going to benefit the top guys more. It's not going to be looking good for Jimmy Walker, but Jimmy Walker's proven himself in the past as an absolute elite world-class player. He's won a major championship. He can be one of those top 50 guys in the game now who have their status cemented in the very elite events next year. There's a lot to play for a lot of guys in the next six tournaments out here in the fall, and Jimmy Walker's one of them.
Been a Ryder Cupper, been a President Cupper, that's where he wants to be.
Exactly. Well, there was another interesting news report at the weekend about Sergio Garcia's efforts to be part of Europe's Ryder Cup squad. We're going to poke that one with Jaime Diaz when we come back.
When it's time to get serious, have an adult conversation, we bring in the great Jaime Diaz. Jaime, I tell you what, every couple of years, the Europeans do this thing, and it feels like there are 12 guys packed in one van together singing ole, ole, ole. What is the value of having all 12 European team members at Wentworth this past week?
You know, I just think it's a continuation of their DNA, which has gone back all the way to 83 when everybody kind of got coalesced, Europe and GBI and everybody. And it just has always been kind of the undercurrent of advantage for Europe. And it's harder to find. And, you know, obviously, U.S. has tried to do it with the, you know, with the thing in, with Phil Mickelson and everybody. With
Tom, the task force. Yes.
Excuse me. And it has worked to some extent, but to some extent, it's also just derivative of what Europe has sort of naturally. And I think this is more a little bit advantage Europe in this moment. You know, they certainly are closer just because of geography and everything else and playing the same tournaments and staying in the same places, even to this day. And so that allows, I think, this sense that they really don't have to force it at all. And when they're together like this, it just, you know, it's team spirit, like Victor Hovland said. And it just does feel like the U.S. will have to travel. Yeah, they have been off. That's good rest, but it may be rust as well. And these guys are coming in firing, having played at a really high level of competition, a big, important tournament. And I think it does give them a sense of we're really ready to play here, along with all these intangibles of unification and the sense of camaraderie that they always seem to have anyway.
This rust idea, I think, is an interesting one as well, because a lot of the U.S. team will not have played at all since the Tour Championship. That's basically going to be a month that will have passed. And what's more important here, confidence or form? I always tend to think that form is overrated going into a Ryder Cup. Particularly, it's overrated as a discussion point with the Americans this time around because there will be that month lag. But when you saw that final leaderboard at Wentworth, I mean, 10 of the top 12, 10 of those 12 guys were inside the top 20 on that leaderboard against a stiff field. That's got to give the Americans a little bit of pause. At least these guys are showing form as they get to
run. Yeah, and they're the horses of these teams. You know, you got Hovland, you got Rahm, you got McIlroy, you got, you know, Tyrrell Hatton is underrated, I think. He can really be an important cog.
It's just more natural. You know, we've all been travel to Europe, and we know the American team as well. It just seems like it's a harder ask, whether we're just more of an individualistic society, more, you know, looking inward. I don't know how the Europeans do it. It obviously most, you know, explicitly shows itself during European Ryder Cups.
You know, and before, the Ryder Cup was a way of saving the European Tour, now the DP World Tour. Now there's an alliance. But I don't know. It just seems like it goes back to those sort of original feelings.
Yeah.
And that was a flagship event. And they all showed up. And they showed up with, you know, real enthusiasm to play well, but also to have, you know, practice rounds and pairings and a de facto team room. Yeah. I mean, it really was the best of both worlds. So, you know, quite an important, timely little momentum builder.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do that, you know, pre-tournament, pre-Ryder Cup. You don't know how things are going to play out. But if you're going to draw something up, this is about the best warm-up you could have.
What do you make of the Jamie Corrigan's news report in The Telegraph over the weekend that Sergio Garcia offered to pay outstanding fines that were sanctions that were imposed on him by the European Tour to try to get his way back onto this team? Obviously, he'd successfully paired with the captain, Luke Donald, in the past, was told it's not an option, you resigned your membership, you're not part of this team. Were you surprised in any way by that report, or you... Does it speak to how desperately he wanted it, or does it speak to how untethered he is in thinking that he could just simply buy his way back onto the team with everything that's gone on?
A little of both, because it is untethered. It couldn't have happened. You know, the team's already been picked. On the other hand, I'm not surprised that, of course, he wants to play on the Ryder Cup. Of course he misses it. This is the reality of having gone to live. You know, you go for the money, you go for the time off, be with your family. Sergio talked all about those things. But you lose the meaning and the relevance and the you know, the gift of glory that you loved.
Can't put a price on that.
Yeah, and he misses it. He wants it back, and it's gone. And it's an eye opener, and it's a rude awakening. But I think it's reality now, and I hope it stays that way, because otherwise, why would you stay with the regular tour or with DP World Tour if you could have everything, you know, that they give you anyway, the Ryder Cup and the majors? And all that money, you know, that becomes almost impossible to compete with. So they have to draw a line.
They do, but it may eventually, it may be a situation where they have everything. They have the money, and they can play wherever they want and play whenever they want.
And the irony of this report coming out on the one-year anniversary of the last BMW PGA Championship, when Sergio litigated his way into the field, keeping other DP World Tour members out, and then quit after one round and showed up on the Saturday at a Texas football game without ever giving the organizers an explanation why he wasn't there. I think he thinks everyone's memory is as short as his is, and that's just simply not true. And if you're the team captain, you might have a John Rahm advocating for Sergio, but all it takes is the sense that one or two people on the team might not be so comfortable with Sergio, and you're not going to take that risk.
It's not good chemistry. And, you know, he is the biggest point getter in the history of the Ryder Cup.
He is.
And that's what Rahm's pointing out. Yeah. But, you know, he hasn't played well in a long time at a high level. I mean, he won the Masters in 2017. Since then, he's played in 23 majors, missed the cut in 14 of them.
Yeah.
And his best finish at any of those is T19. So it's not the Sergio Garcia that really we remember as a great individual, but especially as a Ryder Cup stalwart.
Yeah.
To just say, well, here I am, I'm going to fall back into that role, that's a big ask. I just feel like it's bad on chemistry, but it's also bad on performance. Mm. It wasn't going to happen, and I think it just shows the longing that a once great player who's going to be in the Hall of Fame feels at his greatest stage.
Yeah.
He's not going to have it anymore.
And now more focused on Texas football. Is that why you're wearing burnt orange sweater today, the same color of the Texas?
Yeah,
pretty good.
I did it wrong.
We'll see you on Golf Central in a little bit. All right, speaking of the European Ryder Cup team, we've got one of the team members joining us after the break. Ryder Cup rookie Nikolaj Højgaard has already had success at Marco Simone. We chat with him next. Back on Golf Today, oh yeah, we're counting down the days to the 44th Ryder Cup at Marco Simone. Here's a look at Luke Donald's team heading to Rome, looking for seven straight wins on European soil, a streak that began at Valderrama in 1997. That was before Ryder Cup rookie Nikolaj Højgaard was even born. A couple years ago, the then 20-year-old from Denmark won the Italian Open at Marco Simone, the host of this year's Ryder Cup. The victory marked his first on the DP World Tour. He has gone on to win once more at the Ras Al Khaimah last year.
You saw there his identical twin brother, Rasmus, celebrating that victory with him. Both winners on the DP World Tour. He's now 22 years old, the Dane, and turned pro back in 2019. Played a junior Ryder Cup the same year he won the 2018 European Amateur. We're pleased to be joined now by Nikolaj Højgaard, who's going to be that Ryder Cup rookie next week. Nikolaj, last week at the BMW Championship at Wentworth, you shot 76 in the first round, which was the highest score among the 12 European guys. But you came back with a 67 in the second round. Did you feel a little bit of extra incentive for that Friday round, given how much attention was on the fact that all 12 Ryder Cup guys were on that field?
Yeah, I mean, it was important for me to shoot a good second round, to put myself in the weekend. I didn't want to be the only guy who missed the cut, really. So there was some extra motivation for Friday's round, and I was just happy to play some solid golf and get myself through to the weekend. Yeah.
Nikolaj, what was the biggest benefit of having all 12 members of the European team in the same field at the BMW?
There's a few different things that I think was very important, that everybody showed up to the flagship event in Europe. The other thing is we play the same tournament. We practice together, basically played some practice rounds together. Was in Rome on Monday, which was important for the team room and everybody bonding a little bit more and better. So there were some key things to everyone playing, and I think it was very important for the European Tour, and I think for all of us players to show up and do our best at Wentworth.
Well, all roads now lead to Marco Simone. You won there a couple of years ago. Nikolaj, I'm hearing all these crazy things about how tough a walk it is, physical test, hilly. How would you describe it? Is it a very difficult walk?
It is, yeah. But it's also because of the weather. It's going to be a hot week, it's going to be humid, it's going to, that's why it's draining. It's very hilly, and I think when you get to tournament mode, I would say on a Monday it didn't feel that tough, but you're not really in competitive mindset. As soon as you get into competitive mindset, I think the course will be tough, especially over a lot of rounds on a few days. So it'll be a tricky one physically, but I think both teams got some great people around to make sure everybody is ready.
Nikolaj, you mentioned going with the team on a reconnaissance mission to the golf course last week. Who did you play with when you were out there? Is there any sense of who you're going to be playing with next week?
I think there was definitely a meaning behind it from Luke and the vice captains. I played with John Rahm, Tyrrell Hatton, and Matt Fitzpatrick, and we had a good round. It was a fun round, bonding a little bit more with those guys. I don't normally speak so much with, so it was good to get to know them a little bit better. And I mean, there might be some pairings out of those groups, but I think there's a lot going on at the moment with pairings. So I'm not too much in the loop of who's playing with who, and but there's probably a meaning behind it, yeah.
Well, Nikolai, you have said one of your biggest goals and dreams is to play a Ryder Cup with your twin brother, Rasmus. He did not make this team. What are your thoughts on what he'll be doing next week? What's his role as a cheerleader and, of course, your biggest fan?
Yeah, it's definitely probably the biggest goal for me and Rasmus, that one day we can play a foursome together for Team Europe. And we were hoping and dreaming about it this year, but we'll give it a shot in a couple of years in 25. But he's going to be a key role for me. He's going to be around me most of the week, I think. And obviously he's going to drive around in a buggy with Thomas Bjørn. So he'll be there all week supporting me and supporting whole Team Europe. Yeah, trying to show support so we can get the cup back to Europe.
If you get tired some night during the Ryder Cup and you don't feel like going to that team meeting, could you send Rasmus in, and would anyone be able to tell the difference?
Almost, possibly. There's probably a chance, but there'll probably be a few guys saying, there's a little bit something to him. But we laughed about it and joked about it already, and some of the guys already made a few jokes. And if I don't hit it well in the practice days, I'll just I'll throw Ras in, and he can play in the in the competitive days.
You mentioned Thomas Bjørn as well. Obviously, a veteran of a lot of Ryder Cups, your countryman. He's been the captain. Have you talked to Thomas at all about what to expect, particularly on the opening day, and what the nerves are going to be like?
Yeah, I'm obviously trying to figure out my role in all this, and as a rookie you get in and you're a little bit new to everyone, and you're kind of trying to figure out where are we gonna and what are we gonna do, and my preparation for the Ryder Cup, and for me it's about lowering the expectations a little bit and just trying to get ready for whenever I get the shot. We talked about what my role could be and possibly four balls or whatever, but I mean, as I said, it's just about staying ready. When you get the chance, it's about to go out and trying to perform the best you can. And in the end of the day, it's about getting points to Europe. So just trying to stay ready for whenever I'm getting the call.
Nikolai, speaking of veterans, Adam Scott a couple of weeks ago said he watched you play and it made him sit back and pay attention, a feeling he hadn't really experienced since watching Dustin Johnson. What type of praise does that, what does that do for you? Not that you need more confidence, but when a former world number one and Masters champ is praising your game, what kind of boost does that give you?
It gives me a lot of confidence, and also hearing that from Adam Scott, which is a guy I've been looking up to for my career. And it's pretty cool to hear some things like that being said about you, and it gives you some sort of belief in what you're doing and you're on the right path and trying to build your career. So it gives me some confidence. It gives me the belief that we're doing the right things moving forward.
I saw an interesting quote from Rory McIlroy at the weekend, Nikolai, where he talked about the 2012 Ryder Cup when he was not a rookie. He'd already played in 2010. And he said he went into that Ryder Cup in 2012 at Medina. He'd won majors each of the previous 2 years, and he still didn't feel as though he could speak up in that team room, that he was kind of intimidated by the experience around him. Do you think you're going to feel that way as well? It's kind of speak when spoken to?
I mean, that I don't think, obviously, that the experienced guys and us rookies will probably listen a little bit more. I think that's a natural part of it. And also trying to listen a little bit more and learn from the experienced guys is probably going to be my way of dealing with it. And obviously, if I feel like I got something to say, I would definitely say it. But I don't think there's like an order in the team room. I feel like everyone is a part of it, and we all need to give a little bit of ourselves to the team and to make sure that everybody is well and ready to go. So I think all of us, all 12 of the Europeans, are ready to get to Rome and trying to create a great team room.
Well, Nikolai, we hope you enjoy every hilly step next week. Thanks for the time and best of luck.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
And Nikolai Højgaard trying to keep the 30-year winning streak overseas for the European team. But they did lose the last one back in 2021 when Steve Stricker captained the American team to a decisive 19-9 victory.
Speaking of the Ryder Cup a couple of years ago, how about the U.S. captain, little Steve Stricker appreciation? You see what happened over the weekend? He shot a 4-under 66 to win the Sanford International. Sixth win this year on PGA Tour Champions, just shy of setting the record for the most money made in a single season on the 50 and over set. So dominant. This is a player who was seriously ill late 21 into the spring of 22. So good to see him healthy and playing well. Third player since 2000 to win six or more times. Has earned a record amount of money, nearly $4 million. Leads the Schwab Cup by nearly $2 million over Bernhard Langer. 17 wins. Could he catch Bernhard's record, 46? He's 29 behind in 19 straight top tens. That's fourth all time.
Well, Damon, some of the best women in the world are in Spain this week for the Solheim Cup as the U.S. team tries to stop a losing streak. Beth Ann Nichols is joining us next to assess the American chances. Stay with us.
Back on Golf Today, time now for Road to the Solheim Cup, presented by Ping. It's officially Solheim Cup week. The competition between Team USA and Team Europe begins Friday morning at Finca Cortesín in Spain. You can catch live first day action beginning at 2 a.m. Eastern time right here on Golf Channel.
And this is the U.S. team that Stacey Lewis will lead into battle. And a lot of standouts here, Damon Nelly Korda and Rose Zhang, among others. Suzanne Pedersen's European team, looking for a third straight victory as well, has a lot of firepower.
I agree. Strong. Strength to strength. One of my favorite terms in sports.
Someone who knows a little something about the Solheim Cup is my Golf Week colleague, Beth Ann Nichols, who's now covered 10 of these things. Beth Ann, the last two that you've covered have seen European victories both on home soil and on United States soil. Is there a little more stress on Stacey Lewis this time around when there's that kind of losing record? Because none of her predecessors have, as captain, have come in that kind of circumstances.
I asked her that very question last week, and she said, everyone keeps asking me that. But, you know, she said she doesn't feel it because Stacey's MO is to be over-prepared so that she doesn't feel stressed. That's how she's tackled her own playing career, and she's done the same thing here as Solheim Cup captain. So, you know, there will be no stone left unturned going into Friday's matches just because that's the way Stacey is. But I don't see how she can't possibly feel that somewhere deep down inside, because, you know, she obviously wants to win and she wants her game plan to work. But I do think that she's going to be, you know, extremely organized, and the players are going to know that she's done everything she can to make it work in their favor.
Beth Ann, when Suzanne put this team together, she said it's the best European team ever. We grew up on Annika and Lieselotte Neumann, Dame Laura Davis. Is she right? This is the best European team ever, and are they the favorites?
Absolutely. You know, I think those teams that you're mentioning in the past, those giants in the game, it was very top heavy back in the day, right? And there were always a few European players that folks who even follow the game religiously on this side of the pond would have to Google to figure out exactly who they were and how to pronounce their names. And that certainly wasn't the case in 2021, which was, you know, the best team for Europe today. And in 2023, it's an even stronger team, I would say, you know, top to bottom. So I definitely think that Europe obviously has the momentum with coming off of two victories. They're on home soil. And even though if you check the rankings, technically on paper, there's a slight advantage for Team USA. You've got to think that for the first time in history, the Europeans are not the underdogs going in. They are the favorites.
Lexi Thompson's been such a mainstay on the U.S. Solheim Cup team for so long, Beth Ann, despite still being so young. She made this team based on her world rank card, but she hasn't actually had a top 10 on the LPGA Tour in basically a year. Is she cause for concern this week?
100%. You know, I think you, it's crazy to think of benching Lexi Thompson on purpose for poor play, but I feel like it's definitely possible. I asked Laura Davies just a few days ago, I said, Laura, can you find your game at the Solheim Cup? And she said that she actually has on several occasions in the past gone into the Solheim Cup, not playing well. And then all of a sudden, you know, a little bit more aggressive adrenaline, the support of your teammates, she start making putts that she hadn't been making earlier in the season. But the thing about Lexi here is it's not just about her putter, which is what we're typically talking about Lexi's short game, you know, being wanting. But in this case, it's her ball striking that, you know, has been so reliable for all of her career. She's typically top five on tour in greens and regulation. Right now, she's 72nd. So when the best part of your game is really struggling, you know, of course, we all want to see Lexi flip a switch this week, but I don't think many people are really expecting it to happen.
Well, Beth Ann, what do you think of the first hole at Finca Cortesine, that drivable par four? It worked for Bryson DeChambeau at Whistling Straits when he reached the first green in one.
I'm really excited about this golf hole. You know, it's picturesque. The grandstands are going to be up above the players, behind them. There is definitely a risk reward. There's a huge water hazard on the left. There's a pond that you're going to have to negotiate. But it's downhill. It's only going to play about 280 yards. And Laura said she thinks 80 to 90% of players will go for it. You know, some won't even actually have to hit a driver, which actually I think is more nerve-wracking to tee up your three wood. But I think, you know, we'll see high drama right off the bat. And you can't see the sea from the first tee, from the tee box right there. But as you get down further into the hole, there are beautiful holes, beautiful views of the sea on the left-hand side. And it's typically the fourth hole for the traditional routing of the golf course. But I think fans are going to love this start, both at home and those on site.
Drama 1 through 18, that's how we like it. Thanks, Beth Ann. We'll speak to you later on this week.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
No doubt. Folks at home, here's what you can watch. The Solheim Cup, as mentioned, coverage begins Friday, 2 a.m. Eastern time. Again, Saturday, 2 a.m. Eastern, and then Sunday, 5 a.m. Eastern. A lot of fun to watch the singles unfold. And when Golf Today returns, Ryder Cup legend Sir Nick Faldo is going to join the show. What does he think of Team Europe's chances to take back the cup in Roma? You'll find out next.
Sir Nick Faldo made his first Ryder Cup team just 6 years after he began playing golf, and he beat the best players in the world as a rookie. Europe's greatest player is here to talk about next week's battle, his own captaincy, and whether this team is weaker without his old nemesis, Sergio Garcia. Golf Today continues right now.
Golf Today.
Just a little more than a week away from the start of the 2023 Ryder Cup as the U.S. and Team Europe will compete in Rome at Marco Simone Golf and Country Club. Cannot wait. How about Zach Johnson's team looking to lead the U.S. to its first win on foreign soil since 1993? They go up against Europe. All 12 members having competed at Wentworth and now preparing to compete for continent in Captain Luke Donald.
One guy who's been on 11 European Ryder Cup teams and captain once, Sir Nick Faldo. He debuted here in 1977, just 6 years after he started playing golf. Beat Jack Nicklaus and Raymond Floyd in partnership with Peter Oosterhuis and then took down Tom Watson, the reigning Masters and Open champion, in his singles.
Oh, got off to a fantastic start as a Ryder Cup player. How about 1993 at the Belfry? Look at that swing, looking like Harrison Ford. Another memorable moment. Carding just the second ace in Ryder Cup history. Hole-in-one happened on the 14th of Faldo's Sunday singles match with Paul Azinger, where he would earn a half point.
And then 2 years later, up at Oak Hill in Rochester, it was a rematch of the 1988 U.S. Open playoff. Singles match against Curtis Strange. Curtis got a little wobbly at the end. Faldo came through for the victory.
Love seeing these images. Talk about clutch. 1997, the scene was Valderrama for Captain Seve in Spain. Nick was part of a winning European team that retained the cup 14.5 to 13.5, and the Europeans held a 5-point lead going into Sunday singles, but the Americans mounted a comeback, falling just short of victory.
And it's been a long and glorious record for Nick Faldo. Debuted at the age of 20, 11 consecutive teams, 4 Ryder Cup victories, and of course captained the European squad in 2008 when they lost to Paul Azinger's United States team. And the veteran of those 11 European Ryder Cup teams joins us now, Sir Nick Faldo. Nick, there was this narrative that took root after Whistling Straits 2 years ago that the European team was entering a crisis period. Guys were aging out, and that was all before the live stuff happened. Does this European team now, next week, look any different to you than the strength of European teams in years past?
Well, I would say, yeah, completely different to Whistling Straits. I agree. You know, there was quite a hammering they got. And, you know, the big boys have got it. You know, in any Ryder Cup, if you're going to win, whichever team's going to win, the big three or four have got to do all the heavy lifting. And they didn't that particular week. But now, you know, they were looking for new blood, and they really have found it in this very interesting new strength with Ludvík and Nicolai. So that's pretty cool. You know, and the backbone of the team, look, you know, with Victor Hovland really coming alive, and, you know, Shane Lowry, Bats Fitzpatrick, Tommy Fleetwood, you know, Europe have really transformed things, have really come alive. You know, after America won the, you know, they found some really great pairings in the last President's Cup. But, you know, Europe have really come alive. I'm really very bullish that they should do it. They should win.
Nick, as well as you played in the Ryder Cup, the team lost the first 4 times you were on, 77, 79, 81, and 83, though 83 was a lot closer, just a 1-point defeat. But how difficult was it to maintain optimism during those early losses?
Remember, you know, 77 was still Great Britain. That was the old system, you know. And after that, that's when Jack said, you know, why didn't you expand to Europe? That made sense. We took Seve to the Greenbrier, but we didn't have him at Walton Heath in 81. You know, that was part of the transition. You know, remember, 81 team was there was the 11 out of the 12 were major champions. So that was so. Hey, it took time, but 83 was very significant. You know, when we lost by just 1 point, you know, Palm Beach Gardens, that was historic. There was a historic moment in our lives. I was sitting next to Tony Jacklin. Tony was hoarse. We were prying him with scotch for his throat for medicinal purposes. And Seve came in the room and said, you know, we must celebrate. This is a victory for us. And from that day on, you know, European golf changed. As you know, I mean, 85, 87, to win first time in America, 87 was unbelievable. I'm so, you know, delighted I was part of that. That was a, you know, memory to last a lifetime.
On that note, Nick, how do great rivals like you and Seve or Rahm and Rory today become great Ryder Cup teammates?
Well, you know, you just instantly become part of the team. It's like, you know, as you know, back in my time, I've talked about this a lot, you know, you had to stay as individuals because, you know, I've used the line, if you wanted to change your lifestyle, you had to win. You know, that was where the big prize money was. Now it's obviously completely different now. So you were all individuals and you closely guarded your secrets and your personality and all that sort of thing. But, you know, when you walked in that team room, you wanted the team to succeed. And so, you know, myself, Seve, I mean, in Langer, we had Lazabal, Woozy. I mean, everybody just joined in. It was all just part of it. You just wanted the other guys, you know, we had the Mark James on the team, the Howard Clark, Sam Torrances. It was like if anybody needed any help, you helped them. For that week, if you could see somebody's putting stroke was a bit off, you said, try this, try that. You wanted everybody to play their best. And, you know, so we created a great team spirit in the team room. And then, the most powerful thing is we created some great pairings, you know, having Seve and Lazabal heading out the door first with their incredible record you know, and on that particular day, you thought, yeah, they were going to win. They were going to get a point. So that was just huge for the team. And, you know, I feel I did my part as well with my partners. So, you know, we had Langer doing his bit, and then Monty came on board. So we created some really great pairings, and I think that's what Americas have struggled with over the years, and which they're slowly starting to find now, you know.
When you captained the team back in 2008, Nick, you did things very much your own way as you had as a player. You only had one vice captain, for example, when we tend to see four or five of those roles filled now. When you look back with 15 years hindsight, is there anything you would have done differently in that loss?
Yeah, of course, lots of things. Yeah. But the hardest thing, the worst thing about being a captain is when you finish Monday, that's it, you're forgotten, you're done. You're not talked about. And you can't, and as you know, if I can give a golf tournament as an example, you know, you learn from it. Every golf tournament you play, you've learned from the good bits, the bad bits, the whatever, the whole experience, and you go off and practice and you go again. And you can't do that in the Ryder Cup. Once you finish, you finish. And so I, now that we've lost quite a few potential captains with the LIV situation, I'd strongly recommend that if a player wants to do a couple, you mean, you know, Tony Jacklin did four, Bernard Gallagher did two. You know, I'd strongly recommend that you should be given another opportunity. Maybe it's a two-term, because you learn and you want to deal with things another time, and you can't deal with it. You know, whatever happened on that week is done. You cannot change anything. That's one of my suggestions. I will suggest that when we're down there in Rome, that maybe you should give a captain another shot as well, because it's all part of the learning experience and how you can then make things, change things better for the next time.
It sounds like you want another bite of the cherry, Nick. Would you do it again?
No. I think, as I said, that experience is a tough one. When you go and lose, it's very different to obviously winning. Very winning. You can actually be a poor captain and win, and everything gets brushed under the carpet. But if you don't win, then you're deemed as useless.
Well, you've been in the captain's shoes, as Eamon mentioned, 2008. We're 1 week out. What are Luke Donald and Zach Johnson going through right now?
Well, you know, Europe went down there last week, couple of days. Good idea to do that. So, you know, there's just a lot of communication. You know, now it's very different. Now they communicate probably a lot more. They've all had a good chat, and they've probably already got some kind of little game plan of what they want to do. I mean, it's important to pace yourself. Your captains have got to work out what you're going to do. Obviously, they're probably going to go down there, I assume, Monday at the latest. So they've got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday practice, how much practice needed. You know, it's end of the season. You shouldn't really need a lot of. They now know the golf course, that's important. The golf course is very physical. I've never been there out here. It's probably Fanny Sunderson said it's the hilliest golf course she's ever walked. So that's saying something. So they've got that. They may have already started talking some strategies and partnerships, you know, whether with it being so physical, they want to try and create a four-ball team and a foursomes team. You know, if you have a genuine two swap, you know, you can swap them everybody out. You're probably going to get four players playing all five matches. And if you can swap the other guys, then you get all 12 on the golf course each day. That's always another one to tick the media box, as everybody talks about that one. So, you know, it's, I don't know. They've probably got a lot in their heads. They've got some solid ideas, but you know, you have to duck and dive when you get there. I mean, you'll discover somebody's playing great in practice and somebody's not. And if they're all honest and they talk to their captains, then they give them good insight into what they want to do and how they, you know, when they want to play.
Nick, Jamie Corrigan in The Telegraph reported at the weekend that Sergio Garcia had offered to pay outstanding fines to the European Tour and commit to playing some events if he could be part of a Ryder Cup team, but was told it wasn't an option because he'd resigned his membership. Yeah. Is this team weaker with Sergio Garcia's absence from it?
No, I mean, these guys have moved on. These guys, you've got to be kidding. I think we got one of the strongest teams we've ever had. Plus, those guys haven't played in enough tournaments, or they are in a different world now. You know, they've left the tour. They haven't supported the tour. So, hey, they're done. That's it. You know, the team has moved on. Game has moved on. And the Europe team is fantastic. I don't think they could do anything better. I think they've got a really big, deep backbone. Guys have been around before, and you know, we might have a couple of very interesting secret rookies up our sleeve, which I think is very powerful. If you don't know a lot about a player, they're dangerous, and they're all to gain, nothing to lose, which is a rather nice way to go and play a Ryder Cup.
Which is certainly what you did in 77, when 6 years after you took up the game, you were on a Ryder Cup team and then beat Nicklaus and Watson in the same week. But on that point of the idea of the game having moved on and Europe having moved on, would you apply that to the captaincy as well? Should a Lee Westwood, an Ian Poulter, guys like that, not be considered for the captaincy in the future, regardless of whatever comes out of these talks?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I think the bottom line is they left the tour. They knew what they were doing. They knew that by taking money, it was going to damage. They did it. It was a mathematical equation for them, wasn't it? It was like they knew there was going to be fallout from sponsors and all sorts of things, but they knew they were getting such a huge amount of money. I'll take the money and run. I think that was their attitude. And you know, personally, I think that's it. They're done with Europe. I don't think they should be let back in to represent Europe because, you know, what happened at that particular time was damaging to the European tour. And they wanted to go off on a different path. They chose that. That was their choice, which is fine. But I don't think you can then... Gosh, you couldn't leave your company, could you, and go off and work for a rival company and then 2 years later say, I'll come back and then have a redesign of things for you. I don't think nobody's going to do that in the business world at all. Once you've decided to go off in a new direction, that's it, mate. So I think and I think that European Tour's got plenty of choices now, you know, moving forward. So, as I suggested, give him another go, whatever he decides. I think that is not such a bad idea, simply as I described, because you learn so much, and it'd be nice to be able to put that into good use for another one.
Nick, a lot of great points you make, as usual. Thanks for a few minutes. Enjoy these next couple of weeks.
Yeah, can't wait to get there. Yeah. The food is going to be off the charts.
And the wine as well.
Yeah, I think they're good. We're going for the good life in Italy. I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, a good couple of weeks in the game, and always great to have Sir Nick Faldo on the program. Your thoughts on what he said about Sergio? No road back.
It's no road back for Sergio as a player. It shouldn't really be a surprise because he hasn't played well enough to justify it. To me, I'm not sure his theory is going to hold up with the captains, though. Nick Faldo is a loyalist to his tour, but what June 6th proved is that the tours aren't necessarily loyal in the same way. They're more interested in either expediency, practicalities, pragmatism, and money. And the emotional currents have tended to shift quite a bit among players on this as well. And I would not bet against a Lee Westwood or an Ian Poulter someday down the road captaining a European team, because who knows what new reality is going to emerge from these framework agreement talks. Now, if nothing comes from it, which has been suggested by several people, there are a lot of ifs around this, but if LIV continues to exist and if there are rival tours, then he's probably right that those guys won't be a part of future teams. And it's important to note, I think it's very different in Europe as well. The European Tour owns half of the Ryder Cup. The PGA Tour has no business in the Ryder Cup at all, from the American standpoint. So it's very much a commercial business that is joined. The European Tour and the Ryder Cup are one and the same over there.
And Nick makes a great point about you don't leave a company and go to a rival and expect to be able to come back. But if that rival company is now a partner, if this ultimately is a partnership in the game and the DP World Tour is working with LIV and it's no longer at loggerheads, then you know, who knows what Sergio's game might look like in a couple of years' time. And maybe he's good enough to be on that team.
It's very possible that, you know, we've seen guys in their 50s. Ray Floyd got a captain's pick when he's 51 years old. Sergio Garcia is a long way shy.
He is, but you would think that, you know, he's one of the greatest Ryder Cup players of all time, leading points getter. I mean, if anyone has proven, you know, whatever decisions he's made in terms of his professional career, he's proven what the Ryder Cup means to him with the quality of his play.
Yeah, but that's the problem with the Ryder Cup is that people want legacy picks for what they've done in years past. Doesn't necessarily always hold up. Well, from Italy, we're going to Spain. We're a global show here on Golf Today. We're turning back to the Solheim Cup. Kay Cockerill is on the call in Spain this week, and she's coming up as Golf Today continues. We're back on Golf Today. The 2021 Solheim Cup took place at the Inverness Club. Toledo, Ohio, Team Europe was led by Katrina Matthew that week. They took home the trophy 15-13 over the United States. It was just the second win by a European team on American soil. But they do have two wins in a row as they head to Spain this week. In fact, four of the last six victories have gone to Europe in the biennial competition.
And the UCLA Bruin Kay Cockerill will be on the call in Spain. She joins us now. Kay, it's great to see you. A lot of talk about the players. I'm curious what intrigues you the most about the captain matchup between Stacey Lewis and Suzanne Pedersen.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's going to be a really good captain's matchup. I mean, you have two very intense players in Suzanne and Stacey, but sort of intense in different ways. Stacey was very tough on herself, could kind of get emotionally down during the round because, like many golfers, she was a perfectionist. Suzanne kind of has more of that outward, in-your-face, pump fist. You know, you could sort of just feel the energy oozing off of her. And I think they both probably are going to lead their teams in a similar manner. I mean, I think Stacey's a little more quiet, deep thinking, introspective, and she has she's all about details. Whereas Suzanne, from what I know about her, she's just all passion, right? So I think she's going to really stir her players up, talking from the heart and really reaching in there and grabbing her players and having them work very hard for her.
I'm curious, Kay, if you think there's a little more pressure on Stacey this time around. If you go back, you know, 20 years in when Europe started to win Ryder Cups, every time an American captain would show up on a losing streak, that they looked as though they felt a little bit more weight of pressure, a little bit haunted. Europe's won the last two Solheim Cups. Do you think that's a little extra strain on Stacey Lewis this week, or do you not think that the past is really a factor for her at all?
Oh, I definitely think it's going to be a factor. They want to stop that bad bogey train that they're on right now. And Europe has a chance for the first time to win three in a row. They've won two in a row a couple of times. Maybe it'll be a little bit easier for her mentally because the fact that they're overseas in Spain. I think it would be a lot tougher if she were facing the fact of trying not to lose three in a row in the United States, because you're already come over to foreign soil and you can go into that underdog mode because you don't have the fans behind you. But I know Stacey doesn't want to lose. And, you know, unfortunately there are firsts in the history of sports, right? There was the first time Europe came over and won on US soil. Now done that twice, and now they're looking to win three in a row and really kind of have the upper hand in the last half dozen Solheim Cups. So Stacey definitely has a lot of pressure on her, for sure.
Okay, Lexi Thompson also has a lot of pressure on her. She's been such a part of these teams on the American side. She's missed five of her last six cuts. She has no top tens this season. Does it boil down to the putter, or is there something else going on with Lexi's struggles?
You know, you look at both she and Danielle are the most experienced on the team, yet they're the two that have been struggling the most. And with Lexi, gosh, I watched her in Cincinnati, and I was really impressed with how she hit the ball. She wasn't super consistent. Maybe her wedge play wasn't spot on. But I tell you, her putting stroke looked good. And there was one hole, I think it was the, what was it? It was a par five, like the 14th hole. And she just laced a 3-wood off the deck, 250 to the front of the green. And there are not too many women that can do that. She flew it dead into the center of the green, and it just released over. And I have told a lot of people that I think even Lexi, whether B or B minus game, even a C game, is better than most, because she has so many tools in her arsenal, her power. And I think if she's under Stacy's guidance and kind of her nurturing, and having the team around her, it's going to help her forget the negatives of this year and focus on the positives of match play and team play, which she so loves. And I think the element of match play will allow her to do that. But yeah, she just hadn't had that many reps this year. She hadn't played that much, but she did get in three tournaments towards the end, right before the Solheim. So, and it was good to see her string some good holes together. I honestly don't worry that much about her. Maybe they might not use Lexi as much as they have in the past. She may sit out a few more matches, but I think when she's in, especially in four ball, you can't count her out.
One of the other things for Lexi, I guess, is she's got to feel that next generation nipping at her heels already, Kay, with people like Rosang, Alison Corpuz on the team. They had a successful partnership at the Curtis Cup back in 21. Would you expect that to be resurrected this week in Spain? And are there any other partnerships that you think we're going to see?
Yeah, I think certainly Stacy's taking in all that information and looking back at past successes. And you look at this group of five rookies that they all are tournament winners, and they have three majors between them, which is almost as many as the entire European team has together. You know, Lily Vu paired really nicely with Nelly at the International Crown. So I think that might be a possibility. I think you might even see her put together a couple of the younger players like Andrea Lee and Rose Zhang, you know, the Stanford connection. Would that be too cute? I don't know, but I think those two get along really well. They both have the same type of disposition and very consistent golf games. I think, you know, they're happy pairings in the past where they've put rookies out there together. And I think those two, for example, could handle it.
Okay, this past weekend, I was fortunate enough to MC the National Black Golf Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Our fellow UCLA Bruin, Laree Sugg, was inducted. What do you remember about her? She won her national championship back in 1991 for UCLA.
Yeah, I actually helped recruit Laree, and that was an easy recruit job. She just struck me as such a poised, beautiful, tall, elegant person who had an amazing golf game. And she immediately was a contributor at UCLA. And when I watched her turn professional, I saw that I think like for a lot of us, turning professional is not the easiest thing to do. It's a tough transition, especially when you're just the third Black woman to ever make the LPGA Tour. So I saw her really, I think she was under a lot of pressure to succeed, and it kind of became stifling to her. And I'm so glad to see that she was able, because she was a very bright young woman, and she's able to go on. I think, is she still the athletic director at Richmond?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So really kind of giving back in a bigger way to education.
Well, this is certainly a week for pressure in the women's game as well, Kay. We're looking forward to hearing you on the call in Spain, and have fun out there.
I love match play. I love team play. And remember, guys, this is my 15th Solheim Cup that I've covered, and I've enjoyed them all.
speaking of the ladies' games, get an update on the Epson Tour. That is the road to the LPGA. Auburn Tiger. Sydney Clanton is the winner of the Guardian Championship, which took place over the weekend at Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail, Capitol Hill. This is Clanton's third career win on the Epson Tour. She has 18 top 10 finishes on the Epson Tour. And with the win, $30,000 winner's check, Clanton projected to move to number 27 in the 2023 Race for the Card. Clanton also a winner on the LPGA Tour at the 2019 Dow Great Lakes Bay Invitational. She has 9 career top 10 finishes on the LPGA Tour, 2 wins collegiately at Auburn, and she represented the United States in the 2010 Curtis Cup.
The PGA Tour of Champions is headed to one of the most iconic venues in the game this week, Pebble Beach. A few dozen first tee kids are going along too. One of them is joining us right after this break.
It's always beautiful out there this week. Yes, PGA Tour champions back to Pebble Beach Golf Links for the Pure Insurance Championship with the first tee kids. Spyglass in play as well. Live first round coverage begins Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern time, right here on Golf Channel. And one of those who will be at Pebble Beach, Emily Swagger, 17 years of age from Goodyear, Arizona, senior at Canyon View High, captain and 2022 MVP of the golf team, president of speech and debate, member of the National Honor Society, has packed over 10,000 meals for Feed My Starving Children and volunteers as coach and mentor at First Tee Phoenix. How great to have Emily Swagger with us on this Monday. First of all, what are you most looking forward to in going to a place I love, Pebble Beach?
The views, 100%. I've heard it's the most beautiful place to ever go. So, I mean, if I can have the opportunity just to look out over the water and see the course, I'm going to take it.
Emily, this could be seen as a somewhat intimidating environment for a teenager in high school. What kind of lessons have you picked up along the way from being around golf, being around the first tee, that are going to help you in that kind of situation?
What I picked up is, at the end of the day, if I shank a shot, I'm on Pebble Beach. Like, I shanked a shot on Pebble Beach. You can't go wrong with that. That's a story to tell. And I believe that it prepares me for life and future of just taking things with a grain of salt and going to play my best.
You've shanked a shot on Pebble Beach as well, haven't you?
No comment. I'm going to take the fifth. But listen, I did finish tied for second, Emily, as you probably heard in the run-up to this interview. How are you preparing to bring your best game to Pebble?
I'm ready to show up, show out, and bring a positive attitude and just bring a smile, because at the end of the day, I mean, it's an experience. It's one of those bucket list items. So, I mean, I'm excited to be there.
How did you get into this game in the first place, Emily?
Yeah, so my papa, my grandfather, he had to watch me growing up a lot. So I was on the course watching him, and I was reading a book, and I was watching him hit the range, and that's him right there in that picture. He told me, he was like, I was like, one day I'm gonna beat you. I'm gonna hit the ball farther than you. And he said, let's do it. And he absolutely loved the first tee and how the program was and what it was all about, giving back to kids. And he said, okay, let's put you in it. And ever since then, I strive to beat him.
I love your backstory, the preparing meals, looking for those in need. Why are those important things for you to do?
So I have a single mom. Growing up, I have 3 older brothers, and I have a single mom. So I didn't grow up in the most, extravagant lifestyle. So giving back when I can is absolutely important for me and important for my journey and my path, because at the end of the day, I wouldn't be where I am today without those people that gave back to those kids and are giving back to Feed My Starving Children and organizations like that, because I was like that at one point.
Well, your relationship with your grandfather would suggest that you're capable of absorbing a lot of wisdom from older golfers around you. What are you hoping to get from the pro that you're paired with this week?
I want to know the knowledge of what they feel when they are in those pressure situations. So throughout life, we experience, from what I've heard, that we experience lots of ups and downs and challenges. And I want to know how they handle it, because this is their job. Like, this is how they make a living and they have an income with this. And things happen where they hit bad shots, and I want to know how they mentally process it.
Well, I'll tell you during the commercial break about how I processed some of the good and bad during my week last year. Emily, you have one of the great names in sports. There's like God, Sham God. You got Cameron Champ. Emily Swagger. How much, you know, do your friends kind of tee you up and give you grief about your last name, Swagger? That's a strong, strong name.
Yeah, even my principal calls me Swagger. Our athletic director here calls me Swags. She was rooting me in when I came in to sit down for this interview. She was like, go get them, Swags. And I was like, thanks. It's one of those things where, you know, you create a legacy in life. And I guess if my legacy is Swagger, I mean, there could be worse things that they can call me.
No doubt. Go get them, Swagger. Best of luck at Pebble Beach. And thanks so much for the time, Emily.
Thank you.